Good morning and welcome to this March 9th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information in the second half on how you access those. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors about their books, about their writing process, about creativity and craft, and all those things that go into creating compelling fiction. Today we're doing historical fiction, and in the second half, historical young adult fiction, which is something I don't do enough of, so that's an extra treat to step outside my comfort zone. It's my huge pleasure to welcome Christina McMorris, and in the second half, Ruta Sepetys will be back with us. She was with us in 2011. She's back. Christina McMorris is the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author published by Kensington Books, Penguin Random House Books, and HarperCollins. Her novels have garnered more than 20 international literary awards, as well as a nomination for the IMPAC Dublin Literary Award and a Goodreads Choice Award for Best Historical Fiction. The Edge of Lost is her fourth novel, following the widely praised The Pieces We Keep, Letters from Home, and Bridge of Scarlet Leaves. Christina hails from Portland, Oregon, where she joins me from this morning. My huge pleasure. Christina, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. This was such a compelling read. Before we dive into the novel, I thought maybe it'd be worthwhile for us to sort of set the stage in terms of your kind of general relationship with historical fiction and most specifically with World War II. I know this novel isn't World War II, but the first three were. And I was just kind of randomly booking this morning's show based on what comes across my desk. And, of course, Ruta's novel is about World War II. And yesterday I was chatting with Marcus Zusak for the re-release of the book Thief, which is obviously World War II. And so it sort of got me wondering what it is about this war and what keeps World War II in particular, you know, more than Korea or Vietnam or Iraq, what keeps that war so alive and present? It's almost like mythical. I'd love to get your take on that.
Absolutely. Well, a side note, I have to tell you, since you mentioned both of their names, they are the authors of two of my all-time favorite books, The Book Thief and Between Shades of Gray, of course. And Ruta, is, I'm lucky to say, is a good friend of mine. So it's so nice to hear her name mentioned, and she's gaining so much praise as she deserves.
Love it. Yeah.
As far as World War II goes, you know, for me, it's very personal because my first novel, Letters from Home, as you mentioned, was inspired by my grandparents' courtship letters. And my grandmother kept them in her closet for all these decades from my late grandfather, never mentioned it to anyone. And then it was suddenly, just because I was interviewing her for a family cookbook as a Christmas gift, did she share with me about the fact that she and my grandfather had only dated twice during World War II, fallen in love, and exchanged letters the entire war, and were married for 50 years until he passed away. And then she shared these letters with me out of her closet that nobody knew she had. So what I keep hearing from other people since I published that novel was the fact that a lot of these grandparents are sadly passing away now, and a lot of them are passing along these letters, or they're finding these shoeboxes in the house that are full of these letters, the memorabilia, the World War II photos. And I think we're losing that piece of history so quickly that a lot of people, I think, are trying to hold on to it and realize so much of what happened during that war is very important, but also still applies to today as far as relationships go.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, all of that is going to be changing. You know, I'm sure people communicate through Skype or email now more than written letters. You're right. That is all going away.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to give you a chance to introduce the book, as nobody but the author can introduce their book the best. So tell us, kind of take us into The Edge of Lost, where the concept came from for you, and sort of introduce us to these characters' lives.
Sure, I'd love to. The Edge of Lost starts in 1937 on Alcatraz Island, and that's where the 10-year-old daughter of a prison guard has gone missing. There were roughly about 300 civilians that lived on the rock at the time, which was a huge surprise to me and helped inspire the book. A convicted bank robber is the only person who knows where she is, and he's keeping that secret for a very specific reason. And then the story jumps back to 1919 in Dublin, and you've got the grimy streets of Dublin and the pubs and that whole completely different life. And it follows the journey, essentially, that leads to that moment at Alcatraz. So you've got mobsters and prohibition, Irish and Italian immigrants in Brooklyn, and even vaudevillians along the way.
I love it. I love it. I always like to talk about, you know, there's what the book is about and there's what the book is really about. You know, there's the plot and then there's really what was in the writer's mind and kind of the deeper questions that you were thinking about and grappling with. And I was wondering if you could kind of talk about what the niggling tickle was for you in you know, what these characters had to offer and what underlies the story.
Yeah, well, you know, partially it was inspired also by a family story, and so that, again, became personal to me, even though it was not World War II. Somehow my grandfather found his way again into my story in that he was a dark Irishman who could easily, it was often said, pass as Italian. And I remember that as I was kind of backing up and creating the backstory for this novel. And so little bits and pieces of even my own family story. My father's an immigrant from Kyoto, and my mom's side is all Irish. And so being able to really look at my own family and understand the clash of cultures and generations and the struggle in immigrant families in other countries was really eye-opening and something I think that I was also dealing with myself. Then there's just a large part of the story, as you know, with Neem is about making relationships growing through those relationships, but also finding a family that is not necessarily through blood. And that, you know, I always joke that friends are the family you would have chosen, and that really becomes a major theme in this book, as well as second chances.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the immigrant experience, because, of course, there's not just one immigrant experience. There's as many experiences as there are immigrants. But from the specific, I feel like you were really able to capture the universal and, you know, sort of finding the universal through the story of the immigrant in all caps with Shan's very specific story. And can you talk about that sort of finding the big from the very specific?
Absolutely. You know, I was reading a lot of memoirs when I was researching for this novel as far as Irish immigrants and Italian immigrants all coming through Ellis Island and settling in New York in around the 1920s. And what I was surprised to learn was, as I was reading these, how many universal truths and commonalities that we still have today. So I was, like I said, surprised about the generational clash and these immigrant parents who came to a country like America because they wanted a better life for their families and specifically for their children. And yet coming here, the streets are not paved in gold, and they did not have oranges hanging off of every tree on every corner like some of these legends that they'd been told before they came over, and all of these jobs that are being passed out on every corner if you were willing to work. And so it was interesting to me that so much of that was the same as when my father came over in the 1970s, and yet the decades, you know, such a span in them, and yet there's so many things that were still remain the same. And wanting more than anything, like I said, to have a better life for their family is really their number one goal.
Yeah. And no more is that experience still relevant than today, I think. I mean, you know, we think about all of these things in the past, and, you know, they're certainly as relevant now as they ever were. So I think that's what the power of historical fiction is, to see the patterns and to see the history repeating itself, I think is great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so easy to read these articles, even today in the news, or to read, for me in high school, reading those historical texts that were so easy to brush past or to try to, you know, barely stay awake as you're going through them because they don't feel meaningful as a real person went through these. And so I think that's where, for me, movies and fiction and even memoirs really bring that to life, and you realize there are real people that went through this. And to your point in the beginning of the interview, you know, bringing World War II to life is so important that way, and that it's not just a paragraph in a textbook.
Well, yeah, I totally agree, because I also hated history when I was in school.
Right.
And as I was reading, you know, like Ruta's books are written for a young adult audience primarily, and I was thinking, what a great thing to have these kids exposed to teenagers going through World War II, and, you know, in this book to have young people with all of their range of human emotions and romance and falling in love and, you know, all the complications and crime and, you know, all of the excitement, but also give them the historical perspective of the, you know, this was what it was like. It makes history so much more palatable than, you're right, than those odious textbooks that we all had to endure. Those grainy films.
Yeah, and it's given me personally a different view since I started writing World War II and going back into historical research, 1930s and 20s. Now when I see, for example, sitting on an airplane, sitting next to an elderly person that before I would have probably just been very brief but cordial to and said hello and went back into, you know, my book or my iPad or whatever that I'm working on, and instead now asking them questions about their life and the excitement that you see when someone actually shows interest and you realize that this was a young person at one time who went through an amazing things, really. If they are, say, over 100 years old, how many things that they've seen in this life. And it's fascinating, and I think it's important not to forget that.
I should pull that out as a tool for writers, because how many times are we sitting on a plane and we ignore the person next to them? And no matter who it is, they've probably got a great story to tell. I don't know if everybody's willing to tell it, but what a good idea.
You'll know if they put their headphones on and turn away.
But it's a good idea for writers to be observant wherever you are. I mean, if you're on a bus or if you're on a plane or whatever, you should at least be looking around, you and you know,
yes,
taking your nose out of a book. I love it.
Absolutely. I think it's important as a person just to grow as well and to open your eyes to, you know, to other people and places, cultures, but especially as a writer.
Yeah.
The number one job as a writer, the most important tool we have is being a listener and an observer.
Right, right. Well, to that point, let's get into a little bit of your research process, because this book is so meticulously and heavily researched. And what struck me about the research is, you know, it's not just one time period, and it's not just one place, and it's not just one setting. It's really across the board. It's two continents. It's across, you know, it's across time. It's a lot of different specific settings of Alcatraz and vaudeville and, you know, all of these places. So it feels to me like the research could be very overwhelming. So kind of talk about how you tackled that.
Yeah, mostly it's because I didn't realize what I was in for, which is always probably how the best projects come about, is if you had known what you were in for, you probably would have run the other way. In this case, I really knew Alcatraz was going to be a major part of the story. That's where the story was inspired, of course, knowing that there were children that grew up there and secretly claimed to have befriended some of the inmates. And I thought, wow, that's a story I want to tell. So I thought that was going to be my major point of research, and yet when I backed up with the story and started researching then Dublin and Brooklyn and vaudeville and, like you said, and even burlesque, it takes you down rabbit holes, of course, as a researcher, and you end up sometimes researching for days for one small paragraph. But I'd like to think at least I learned a lot along the way. It always has to try to serve the story. But my favorite parts of research on this book in particular was interviewing a person who grew up on Alcatraz as the daughter of a guard there, so that was great, and then going and taking a night tour of Alcatraz. Those are probably my two favorite parts, just being there when I had done so much research and knew exactly what I was looking for at the time, and to be there at night, not just during the day, but being able to walk down those corridors and sit in the cells and walk through the mess halls was wonderful.
Yeah. There's such a romantic notion of Alcatraz. I feel like Alcatraz has such a hold on us for some reason, more than other prisons, more than other places. And I'm trying to wrap my mind. It does for me, too. I've been out there, and it's compelling, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what it is about that place that really digs into us. Do you have any insights on that?
I'm not sure. You know, I've kind of asked myself the same question. Maybe it's because maybe a lot of people like me grew up watching Escape from Alcatraz with Clint Eastwood.
Yeah,
so
right.
I watched that movie a lot as a kid when I probably should have been watching cartoons. And I was always fascinated by it, I think, ever since then. But I think there is something that's very legendary, mystical about it. When you have such famous mobsters that, of course, in reality were pretty terrible and horrific crimes that they committed, and yet because of, maybe largely because of film, that there's a bit of romanticism to it, with that whole upper class sort of tailored suit mobster criminals that are like Machine Gun Kelly and Al Capone and the Birdman of Alcatraz, and having those names that we associate with Alcatraz.
Yeah. The other thing that struck me as a great tool for writers is to juxtapose things that don't seem to go together. So the children of Alcatraz, I think, you know, picturing childhood innocence right up against this, you know, famous criminals is really a powerful image in your head, and really a great jumping off point for a writer.
Yeah, I loved that. Of course, that was for me a big inspiration. It was also the fact that once I started researching, right to your point of juxtaposition, I found out that there were greenhouses on Alcatraz that the inmates would run, completely care for, and sometimes even build themselves. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, what a crazy dichotomy that you leave your dank, concrete, tiny cell to go work in a room that is full of flowers and things that are blooming and colorful vegetation, and spend the day there, sometimes roaming 7 days a week if you were really a trusted inmate and were under limited supervision, and then had to go back to your cell at night.
Yeah, right. Actually, that leads us into a segue into your reading, I think, which would be a great time for that. If you can read to us, my guest this morning is Christina McMorris. The book is The Edge of Lost. And if you can read the prologue to this, that would be awesome.
I would be happy to. So I've got a brief prologue in the beginning that begins, as I mentioned, on Alcatraz Island in October 1937. Fog encircled the island, a strangling grip as search efforts mounted. In the moonless sky, dark clouds forged a dome over the icy currents of San Francisco Bay. "You two check the docks," shouted Warden Johnston, his voice muffled by rain and howling wind. "We'll take the lighthouse. The rest of you spread out." More people traded directives, divvying up territory. They were off-duty guards and teenage sons who called Alcatraz their home, an odd place where a maze of fencing and concrete kept families of the prison staff safe from the country's most notorious criminals, at least in theory. From inside the warden's greenhouse, inmate 257 strained to listen. That was his number. Even his coveralls bore a stamp of his designation, branded like cattle. The beam of a searchlight brushed past the glass-lined walls. Over and over in the dankness of his cell, he had envisioned this very scene. Had seen it clear as the picture shows he grew up watching in Brooklyn. The Mask of Zorro, he recalled. It was the first swashbuckler he'd ever viewed on the silver screen. The film was silent long before talkies became all the rage, but the action and suspense had quickened his pulse, gripped his lungs, same as now. He drew a breath, let it out. Raindrops grew insistent. They tapped the ceiling like 50 anxious fingers, 70, 100. "Hey, Capello!" His heart jolted. Normally, he stayed keenly aware of sounds behind him, a survival tool in the pen, but somehow he'd missed the creak of the door. He tightened his hold on the garden trowel before turning around. It was Finley, a guard with the look and nose twitch of an oversized ferret. "Yeah, boss? You seen a little girl pass by? 10 years old, light brown hair, about so high." The answer needed to sound natural, eased out like fishing line. "No, sir, afraid I haven't." Atop the single entry step, Finley surveyed the room with an air of discomfort. He wasn't a proponent of the rare freedoms afforded to past men, the few trusted inmates assigned to work at the warden's house. "Aren't you about done here?" Finley asked. "Sure am. Then I'll be heading to the lower greenhouse to finish up." Finley hesitated, an endless moment of gauging, of suspicion. At last, he gave a partial nod and turned to exit. The door swung closed. Adrenaline rushed with the force of the pounding rain. The risks and consequences gained new clarity. Doubt invaded his thoughts. It wasn't too late to turn back. He could serve out his time by sticking to the grind, sleeping and eating when told, and one day walk out a free man. But no, it wasn't that simple. Not anymore. He recalled just how much lay at stake, and any chance of reneging crumbled. Through the fog, lightning cracked the sky. The air brightened with an eerie blue glow, and from it came a boost of certainty. He could do this. The plan could work, so long as they didn't find the girl.
Awesome.
And that's the end of the prologue.
That's awesome. That was Christina McMorris, The Edge of Lost. It's so funny because I'm in this writer's group, and we've had this long debate over prologues. And a lot of
sure,
people...
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, a lot of people say, you know, why don't you just incorporate it as chapter one of the novel? And we had just had that debate last Thursday night again. And as I was reading this, I was like, this is the perfect example of when a prologue works, because this prologue stands alone, and then we really go way back in time and catch up to it. But I feel like it's a necessary anchor for the book to know that Alcatraz is there, and to know that about the missing girl. And it's a perfect example of when a prologue is awesome.
Oh, thank you. I originally, on that note, I originally made it a chapter one before I gave it to my editor and wrote the whole book with that as a chapter one, because I know people are sometimes sensitive to prologues if it's not really necessary to make it a prologue. And yet, when I was finished writing the book, I really debated on making that a prologue and gave it to a beta reader who said, this really needs to be a prologue.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you expect it to jump back forward again and go back and forth because dual timelines are so common today. And I had no intention of doing that. So, of course, that made more sense.
Yeah, right. No, it makes perfect sense. And listening to you read it, and one of the things that I had wanted to talk about is your fantastic dialogue throughout this. And, you know, you've got this lovely woman, wife, mother from Portland, Oregon in the 21st century, channeling so well the dialogue of the Irish immigrant and all the various characters of the 1920s.
The drunken Irish.
Yeah, the drunken Irish. And dialogue, I mean, dialogue's so hard, and making these characters sound authentic and distinct and different from each other is hard. So how do you do that? Tell me how you do that.
You know, for all my books, because I have a much longer background in TV and film, growing up I started hosting a kids' TV show when I was 9, and because of that I eventually became a reader, but it's not where my foundation is. And so for me, when I come up with a story idea, I actually see them as a film in my head. So I write down the film in a novel form, and so dialogue, because I'm such a movie buff, is really important to me, and I hear their voices. It sounds like I should take a special pill from a psychiatrist, and yet I really get the distinct voices from them because I see them as characters on screen. And so because of that, I read my manuscripts out loud before I turn them in and read it to usually my mom, who's a great listener and a really great auditory editor. So when she hears it, she is great about catching me when she feels it's ringing false, and that really helps with dialogue.
Oh, that's great. I wonder if that movie setting also helps with the rich settings that you create in the book. You know, that if you're visually seeing it as if on a screen, if those details then translate to making these places feel so alive.
Yeah, I think so. For me, it does anyway, because I do see them, and I can sort of get the smell and the feel and what those Irish pubs would smell and feel like, and the vibration in the air and the intensity of each one of those situations.
Yeah, right. There's such a huge cast of characters in this, and I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about minor characters and how much you feel like, how much of their lives you have developed off the page, and how you make them kind of fully rich characters who aren't just serving, you know, the main characters of the story, but who have, you know, desires and, you know, complications of their own. How much time do you spend on your minor characters that, you know, maybe don't make it into the novel but really inform who they are?
You know, with every minor character, they become some of my absolute favorite characters in every book, and I have to be careful they don't take over the story, because so often I'll start writing them, and I feel like I just need a character for this. It needs to be a shopkeeper if he's working there, et cetera. And so you put one in, and yet they come alive to me, and they have an entire story behind them of why they're kind, why they're snappy, why, you know, they are short with someone that day or kind of gruff and distant from people. There's a reason why everyone obviously acts the way they do in even real life. And so I try to keep that in mind as I'm writing them. And so often I end up writing their short monologue or their few pieces of dialogue that have become important and realize that they could have their entire own novel on their own because I get a sense of where they came from. And that's really fun.
That is fun. That is fun. So tell me about the structure of how you do this. Do you write the novel all the way through and then go back and revise, or do you... I hear some writers even write it out of order, which I don't know how you do that and replace it back together. But tell me a little bit about your process and your revision process.
Yeah, you know, it's mind-boggling to me how some of my author friends can do that. So they can write it completely out of order and piece it together, and they'll write a scene here, fill the scene with this, and they move on. And I think I'm too much of a type A personality to let that go. I just stare at the blank screen instead because I can't move past it until I feel like it's in good shape where it is and then move on. So for me, I am a slow writer. I don't just punch out the draft, which sometimes I wish I could just do that and give myself that permission. When you're on a deadline especially, that would be nice.
Right.
But in my case, I really edit as I go heavily so that I maybe will get through 4 to 5 pages a day, and that's it. But they're very clean by the time I get done, and the next day I tidy those up a bit more and then keep going. And so I have to be really careful I don't keep backing up to page one. Mm-hmm. But when I am done with writing the first draft, there's usually very little I need to do to it. So I will go back and give it to readers at the same time that I'm editing and incorporate things I agree with, and I comb through it one time and before I give it to my editor.
Oh, I love
it. And then
it.
After that, of course, I go through it a few times between copy edits and page proofs and all those steps until it goes to print. But for the most part, it really is, you know, a little crazy the way that everybody has their own system. But I really do probably only read it once or twice all the way through before I turn it in the first time.
Well, it strikes me that the advantage of doing it that way is you don't have as much ability to get lost in the forest from the trees when you're really present in exactly how it goes. I mean, I hear a lot of people vomit on the page and then, you know, it's just a big fat mess, you know, 500-page mess. And you've got to clean it up. So it strikes me as overwhelming, you know. So
It would overwhelm me completely if I just threw it all out there, and then like NaNoWriMo to me is a nightmare.
I could not do that.
But I'm jealous of people who can. But for me to be able to throw it out there and then go back, I feel like I would be wasting so much of my pages and my time, and I'd rather just feel like I could do it slowly but do it the right way.
Yeah.
For that's my process.
Yeah. What did this book teach you, either as a writer, you know, of what you will do, take away from how you did this or what you learned from it into the next book, or as person, kind of what came out of this project for you?
Gosh, there's so many things, but I realized how much I love historicals, of course, and not just being World War II, and also the relationships, how often I've heard from readers that you've got an Alcatraz escapes and mobsters and speakeasies and all these fun things that I love to write about. And yet what I hear the most from readers that they enjoyed so far has been the relationships, the family especially, the Irish and Italians mixing together and the immigrant experience. And so, which makes me so happy because that really is not the flashy part of the story. Of course, Alcatraz, you know, has got like neon lights on it on the front cover.
Right.
And so you would think that that would be what people were more excited about. It was the action, and it really is interesting to me how much more the characters they latched onto. So I love that. That feels very rewarding, and that feels very real. And so I think that moving forward, I that will be, again, another focus for the next book, another historical. And the other thing I loved with this book was writing completely a male point of view, which I've always mixed them in every book. It's always been male and female. And this time I wrote completely a male point of view, and I loved doing that. It's my favorite types of point of view to write.
Yeah, you nailed it. You nailed it. And as I was going through some of, you know, people's comments on Goodreads and whatnot, people fell in love with this guy. I mean, they just really connected with him and, you know, wanted to follow him. And that has to be so gratifying as a writer. It's really great.
It is. It is, especially knowing that part of it was inspired by my grandfather makes it even more rewarding. And he was a wonderful character to write. I enjoyed, kind of sounds strange, like it's a real person, but kind of watching him grow.
Yeah, right. I love it. Any last-minute words of advice for writers?
You know, the biggest thing I always tell people, besides, of course, write on that blank page and force yourself, even if you don't feel like it, get it out there, but is that when you are ready to lower your defenses and allow people, friends and writers and readers, to give you input, and yet pick and choose like a cafeteria line what works for you, because I think it's very easy to edit out your own voice because of trying to make everyone happy.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that is that is great advice. And I want to let our listeners know that you have a great website, which is your name, ChristinaMcMorris.com. Where people can find out not only about The Edge of Loss, but they can find your other books. There's a little interview with you up there and more information about you. I know you're on Goodreads. Yeah, I think you're on Facebook. You're all over the place. I love it.
I'm everywhere.
You're everywhere. Are you doing any Southern California visits for this book?
I am. I'm actually doing an event in San Diego. I'm heading for the Tucson Festival of Books, like Ruta, this coming weekend. And then going straight to San Diego and doing an event this coming Monday at Hooley's Pub. It's with Adventures by the Book, so people can find that on my website as well, and all my events on there. But I'll also be doing a book signing and author chat with my mother, who's also an author.
Oh, that's great.
And so that'll be fun. We've never done a book chat together, and we're going to do one at Upstart Crow in San Diego on March 22nd. So that should be a lot of fun.
Super fun. I love it. I love it. Christina McMorris, this was a huge treat. Thanks so much for this.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Christina McMorris. The book is The Edge of Lost. We're going to take a very short break. Ruta Sepetys will be back in the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Onward with the show. Born and raised in Michigan and now a longtime resident of Nashville, Ruta Sepetys is considered a crossover author. Her critically acclaimed novels, Between Shades of Gray and Out of the Easy, are read by both students and adults. Ruta is a New York Times bestseller, a two-time Carnegie Mellon nominee, and is currently published across 48 countries and 35 languages. Her debut novel, Between Shades of Grey, was a New York Times bestseller and received widespread acclaim. It was a New York Times notable book of 2011 and appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Publishers Weekly, Booklist, Kirkus, and iTunes Best Book of the Year lists. Between Shades of Grey is now headed to the big screen in a feature film entitled Ashes in the Snow. Ruta was on the show with me back in 2011 with that novel, and our interview of that can be found online. In 2015, Ruta was awarded the Rockefeller Foundation's prestigious Bellagio Center writing residency based on her latest historical novel, Salt to the Sea. That's our primary subject of our chat this morning. Ruta, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be back.
I love having you. We had, in fact, I went back and listened to our interview from 2011 and refreshed my memory on how much I love having you, because we you were filled with amazing, yeah, you were filled with amazing insights then, as I know you will be now. So since we last talked, I loved hearing that Between Shades of Grey is being made into a film. That's awesome. Congratulations.
It's incredible.
It's incredible. It is. I was wondering, you know, do you see these novels as movies when you're writing them? I do. So
Well, I know that some authors, you know, absolutely don't want their novels adapted to, you know, to film. They are fearful that maybe the films will ruin it. But because I write about these little-known pieces of history, these underrepresented stories, I'm desperate for the books to be turned into movies. And my process of writing is a bit cinematic. As I'm writing, and especially creating dialogue, I'm imagining the characters interacting with one another and speaking. So yes, I do sort of have a cinematic approach.
It's funny because Christina McMorris and I were talking in the first half about this pull that World War II has on us in a way that other wars don't. And we were talking about, you know, how it's so much more palatable to young adult audiences to hear the stories of these people rather than reading the odious history tomes and textbooks and seeing the grainy films and all that stuff. So I think it's, you know, such a great service to young adult readers who may be suffering through history to read about teenagers and all their operatic teenager emotions of, you know, love and lust and all the things that teenagers are going through in the backdrop of history. And, you know, then you can force feed them history if they don't want it.
Yeah, and not even, you know, force feed, but I completely understand. You know, sometimes history can be sterile and it can be a bit boring, but through characters and story, history becomes human, and suddenly we care for people we've never met, and that's one of the many powers of books and story, and fiction can be a facilitator that way, to sort of open the door in an exciting way to history.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, speaking of unknown little corners of history, why don't you take us into Salt of the Sea, because this I had not heard of this part of World War II, so kind of take us into what the novel is about and how you found out about this and you know, who these people are.
Sure. Salt to the Sea is set in winter of 1945, near the end of World War II, and everyone has heard of the Titanic, the leisure cruise ship that sank tragically in 3 hours and over 1,500 people lost their lives. But at the end of World War II, there was a ship that sank that was carrying over 10,000 people, and over 9,000 people lost their lives. It was torpedoed by a Soviet submarine. And the death toll of this ship, the Wilhelm Gustloff, dwarfs the death toll of both the Titanic and the Lusitania combined. Yet somehow, this is a story that has slipped through the cracks. And so Salt to the Sea tells the story of four characters, four young people who are all hunted and haunted by tragedy and lies, and their fates converge as they arrive at the port to board this doomed ship.
Do you have any insight as to why this was completely? I've never heard of this, and you're right. I mean, everybody's heard of the Titanic. How did this slip out of our historical consciousness?
I know. I hadn't heard of it either. And it made me wonder, you know, what determines how history is preserved and recalled? And why do some parts of history penetrate our collective consciousness and others remain hidden? And in the case of Salt to the Sea, which chronicles the the largest single maritime disaster in history, the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff. I think there were a few contributing factors as to why the story is unknown. First, the ship was a German ship, and when it sank, the Nazis tried to conceal the story. They didn't want people to know that a German ship, you know, had sank, and there was such a large loss of life. They thought it would affect morale. And then on the Russian side, the ship was torpedoed by a Russian submarine, and the commander of that Soviet sub was dishonorably discharged from the military. And so the Soviets weren't talking about it. And then after the war, the Germans said that considering their atrocities during World War II, they did not feel it was appropriate at all to position themselves as victims in any way. And so they didn't speak about the sinking of the Gustloff, even though, you know, there were 9,000 civilians and children on the ship.
Wow. Well, yeah, that does answer that question. That does make sense. So when we talked in 2011, your research process for Between Shades of Grey was so extensive. You had locked yourself voluntarily into a recreation of the Soviet camps, which sounded horrific. And I know that you had boarded a Lithuanian train car and sort of spent time in there. Tell me a little bit about the research process for this novel.
Well, for Salt to the Sea, I spent 3 years researching. And mind you, I love the research process. It's like being a historical detective. And I traveled to half a dozen countries and conducted countless interviews and hours of research. And I went first to Poland. The ship sank off the coast of Poland. And my publisher in Poland was able to locate two of the original divers who dove the wreck after the ship sank. And by this time, these men were very elderly, the ones who were still alive. But they created such an atmosphere and such a vision for me of what they had experienced. And that really helped me put together the story and determine how I was going to, you know, to draft this. And they described that it was like swimming through a forest of black bones and just how tragic it was. So the divers themselves really helped me. But then I interviewed passengers' families, people in Lithuania, in Denmark, Sweden, Germany, you know, I mean, literally all over. And then, of course, you know, in addition to evacuating human beings, the Germans had plundered a lot of art and treasure, and they certainly didn't want to lose that. And so it was rumored that the two holds on the ship were packed with treasure and valuables. And that is a part of a storyline that I've woven into Salt to the Sea. So I also had to do a lot of investigative work on not only what may have been on the ship, what sank, what had been retrieved, and it was just such a fascinating journey. My publisher finally said, okay, enough research, start writing.
Yeah, I mean, it does strike me that you could really go down the rabbit hole with research and never emerge. I mean, and kind of when do you know that you've done enough? I guess when your editor taps you on the shoulder and says you've done enough. But
well, no, of course, yes, that's one. And I do try to write as I'm researching because some of the information that I get is so emotionally charged that I'm worried that if I don't write, that the novel might lose a sense of emotional immediacy and, you know, the hope, the horror that I'm hearing all about. So I do write as I'm researching, but then as I'm going through the process, when I begin to hear the same stories over and over or meet the same information over and over, I feel that, okay, well, maybe I've reached a point where, I mean, there are always additional stories and there's always another rock to be, you know, turned over. But when I start hearing the same thing over and over again, that's when I know that I really need to get writing.
Yeah, right. And when we talked before, and it's true in this novel as well, the balancing of atrocity and horror and, you know, and balancing it with some light and hope and love and all of those things. I know then we talked about, and this novel does it too, a lot of white space and a lot of short chapters and a lot of room for the reader to be able to breathe and, you know, digest what they've read. But filling it with hope and light, this feels almost even doing that better than Between Shades of Grey, where, you know, it was, maybe it's the characters. I just felt like they, it just felt a little lighter to me.
No, that's a huge compliment. Because I worked very hard to strike that balance. Even though I do believe that, you know, they go hand in hand. I feel that love and death and beauty and horror, you know, that they deepen the life experience and allow us to really see the full dimension of the other. For example, if we've never loved, we don't feel loss. And when we feel loss deeply, that's obviously because we've loved, and there's beauty to that. And so in Salt to the Sea, I wanted to illustrate that in a way that, you know, readers would be moved by it and bring beauty to the horror, if that's possible.
Yeah. I love the title. Was that always the title? It's a great title.
Oh, thank you, Salt to the Sea. Yes, it was always the title, and I chose it because the human body needs salt. And there is salt in our sweat, there is salt in our tears, and these refugees that were fleeing, these civilians, oh, there was so much sweat and tears. And water evaporates, but salt is eternal, and I want these stories to live on. There were over 9,300 people who perished on the Guslof, and each one has a story. Each one gave their salt to the sea, and that's why I chose that title.
I love it. I love it. I think it was either I read this of you or we talked about it before, but the beauty of not doing this as a nonfiction book, by doing it this way, it captures more of the universal experience because you can kind of take a bunch of people's experience and put them into these four distinct characters. So maybe talk about the it's told from four points of view, four teenagers, and kind of introduce us to these four, how you settled on them, how you thought about them, and, you know, kind of how you mined them out.
Certainly. And because I write historical fiction, I am given the framework. History, you know, I write the books, but history writes the story, so to speak, and history provides this framework. And where I can really, my creative process kicks in is with the creation of the characters. And what I learned in my many years of researching Salt to the Sea is that we all view history, and story for that matter, through our own cultural lens. If we are of Polish descent, we see World War II one way. If we are of German descent, we see it entirely another way. And because there were so many regions and ethnicities represented at the end of World War II, I wanted to represent those cultures. So, as you said, I tell Salt to the Sea through four characters in alternating chapters. And we have a Lithuanian nurse, a young Polish girl, an East Prussian art thief, and a German sailor who is sort of our eyes and ears onto the ship. And they all have very different personalities, and that was certainly a challenge in the writing process, to create voices strong enough for each character that as the reader is reading, they don't even have to see whose name is at the top of the chapter, that the voice could be so strong that they would immediately know whose head that they are in. And so, of course, it took quite a bit of revision, but I really enjoyed telling the story that way. And you mentioned the white space in the novel. And, yes, I do. I choose my words very carefully. I think that authenticity is specificity, and I work very hard at that. The other thing I work very hard with in creating my characters is rhythm and flow. I spent over 20 years in the music business prior to becoming an author, and I learned from some of the great songwriters, you know, who were distilling story down into a 3-minute song. And so I read my chapters aloud, listening for rhythm and flow, and your listeners might understand this comparison that, for example, we could read something this morning and 5 minutes later not be able to recite what we read. However, maybe we'll be in the car and we'll hear a song on the radio that we haven't heard in 5 years, but yet we can sing every single word to the song. And that's because melody and rhythm make something memorable. So in creating my characters in the prose, I also really focus a lot on rhythm.
I love that. I love that. And I love just being around the creative process of other artists and seeing how they, you know, how songwriters, or I like it in the visual arts too, how they think about their art and how many comparisons there. It's actually more similar than you would think, even if you're working in a completely different medium. But music, I think, is really the best example of this, that you write through poetry and rhythm, and how words sound together is invaluable for a writer. Writers should all listen to music.
I agree.
Should all hang out with other musicians. Yeah, that's great. That's great. You know who I loved was the shoe poet. He was a minor character in the novel, and he was just so rich and so visual to me. I really am always fascinated with the minor characters and how much, I don't even know if he was a minor character, but he was. I always wonder of authors how much time they spend with the minor characters and how much of the minor character's life exists off the page, and you know how much you know about him that didn't make it into the book.
Well, as I said, for me, because history is really writing the stories, and I'm not coming up with, you know, the events and, you know, the game plan, it's there day by day. If I, you know, through World War II, I can see this. But so really creating the characters is where I can become involved. And so I do with the secondary characters. I am very involved in the character of the shoe poet, an elderly man who is on this refugee trek, you know, walking to freedom. And he is sort of a lamplighter amongst these young people. He is full of wisdom and hope and love. And he spent his entire life making shoes and explains to the other characters how the shoes tell the story, how, you know, the way someone walks, he can tell so much about them, if they've had a prior injury, you know, how they carry themselves. He could tell so much just by looking at someone's shoes. And I absolutely loved creating this character of the shoe poet. And he came to life for me, actually, when I was on a book tour in Italy. My books are published for adults in Italy, and I tour there often, and I was in Rome, and I was walking down this little street, and there was a sliver of a window between two shops. It wasn't a shop itself. It was just a window that was sandwiched in between two stores. And in the window was one pair of shoes on a pedestal. And I asked my Italian publicist, "What is this?" And she said, "Aruta, this is the most amazing shoemaker. His shoes are pure poetry." And I thought, a poet of shoes, a shoe poet. And I ran back to my hotel, and I sketched out the character of the shoe poet on the hotel stationery. And he came to life for me just in that moment, you know. And those moments, like you say, the creative process, that's so exciting.
I know a lot of women who would back up the idea of shoes as poetry, so that resonates perfectly.
Yes, exactly. And I had to study shoes in such an in-depth way, what sort of, you know, a foot draft, actually, what you can tell. And in the book, I say that you can actually tell more about someone by their foot draft than by their fingerprint. And so I was studying this in different kinds of shoes and making shoes. And you know, so yeah, I had a blast with that.
I love it. So this is your fourth book. Is there ever a time that you've started a book and you realize that it just doesn't have the legs to carry it? Or does every idea that come to you, you're pretty confident that it's going to make a great novel?
Well, I mean, I'm working on my fourth book now. Salt to the Sea is my third book. And so far I haven't had an experience where I've had to abandon a project. But I imagine, you know, that, of course, that will probably happen at some point. It probably happens to all authors. Right now, for example, I'm working on a novel that is set during the Franco regime in Spain. And while my first three novels, you know, I was familiar with the time period and the cultural experience because it's something that my own family experienced. But now, writing about the Franco regime in Spain, it's something that is more difficult for me. And, And I don't know. I hope I can do it. I keep challenging myself. I don't want to give up. But yes, it's been harder.
I love it. And I love kind of operating outside your comfort zone and, you know, exploring new territory and trying new things. And it's all part of the great growth process of writers and human beings, right?
It absolutely is, and I've already been to Madrid many times for research and spent, rented an apartment there and just was sort of boots on the ground there, and I just love it. And that is something else. I'm so fortunate to be published in over 40 countries, and I have to thank my translators because I certainly, I barely speak English. I certainly couldn't write a book in all these other languages. And the translators are really the unsung heroes. And I'm so grateful to them. And as a result, I have these relationships with publishers in different countries, and they help me.
Yeah,
as I said, my publisher in Poland, helped me with Salt to the Sea. Now my publisher in Spain is helping me with my new novel.
It's so fun. I love talking to translators. I think that's its own really interesting art of
absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. Any last-minute words of writing advice for young adult authors or historical fiction novelists or writers in general?
Yes, I want to say that please, just keep in mind that writing, good writing, is revising. And to give an athletic comparison, if you're an athlete or if you're in a theater production, if you had the chance to go back and correct a play or correct a scene in a performance, wouldn't you do it? Of course you would. And as writers, that's the opportunity that we have to constantly make our work better before we turn it in. And I meet so many writers that become discouraged if the work isn't accepted right away, or I'm more of a reviser than a writer. So I would say just, take the revising more seriously than you take the writing.
That's great advice. And you're right. People are way too eager to get published and not as eager to sit in the chair for the numerous drafts that it takes to make something fantastic. So, I was talking to the book thief man yesterday, Marcus Zusak, and I
Oh, you're kidding me.
Written so many times. It just sounded like he started over and started over and started over. And you realize why it takes novelists 10 years to write something, but then you have something fantastic and, wouldn't you rather have that than the first draft?
Master. Marcus Zusak is the master. So if he says that, everyone has to trust Marcus Zusak.
Yeah, right.
I adore him.
He even had copies in the latest book of his first drafts of, and you can see how, I'm not going to say how bad it was, but you can see how far it came from his first drafts to where it ended up. And if he would have been, rushed to publication, that book would not be what it is. So, yeah, take the time. Take the time. Ruta Sepetys, this was a huge, huge treat. Thanks so much. I always love having you on. So, and congratulations on the movie and all the books. It's great.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You too. That was Ruta Sepetys. The book is Salt to the Sea. You can find her all over the place. She's on Facebook. She has a great website. She's got interviews up all over the place. So check her out. She's wonderful. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, stay tuned. Natalia is going to be here for Filling the Voids. Stay tuned for that. You have been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Have a great day.